To understand better the universe of crime, its inner workings and machinations, its relation to the law-abiding, it is important to comprehend its terminology, slang, and argot. This encyclopedia has been researched exhaustively and compiled to provide that understanding. This encyclopedia is the most up-to-date, comprehensive work of its kind. It provides the reader with the ancient and modern jargon of the underworld, the terminology of law enforcement and criminal justice, and the arcane language of organized crime. The more than 22,000 terms found in the Dictionary of Crime stem from the streets, gang territories, crime laboratories, prisons and police lockups, from the mouths of beat cops, homicide and vice detectives, insurance investigators, private detectives, and crime and police reporters. These terms have been channeled to the public for decades, mainly by the nation's press. Since the early 19th century, newspapers have chronicled the slang of the underworld and made its language part of common usage. It was through the newspapers that the public first learned the word gangster, long before the turn of the century. The word underworld originated with Chicago newspapers inspired by Roger Plant, an immigrant from England and a petty thief of the mid-19th century who became the city's first crime boss. When Chicago planners learned that the city was sinking into bogs, the town was leveled and a new city was built on top of the old in 1857-58. In the construction of the new Chicago, large cavernous underground areas of the old city could be entered near what is now Monroe and Wells Street. At the opening to this underground area sat a two-story structure that rambled for a half a block. Plant, the owner, called his den Under the Willow, after a huge, sickly willow tree that towered over the building. Plant moved into the underground caverns with his minions and established more than 60 huge rooms. Some of these he rented for considerable sums to much-wanted fugitives. He and his wife ran gambling dens, whorehouses, and others, and made storage areas for countless stolen goods that they bought and then fenced for enormous profits. Also in this sprawling underground area, Plant and his wife operated schools for prostitutes and pickpockets. It became the home for hundreds of the worst criminals of the day. Police were powerless to clean out the area, which they dubbed the underworld, meaning a world that literally existed beneath another, one criminal and the other law-abiding. Plant paid off officials to keep police from raiding his underworld, but on a few occasions, at the insistence of social reformers, squads of police attempted to clean out the area and were soundly thrashed by Plant's army of hoodlums. Moaned one police captain, trying to raid the underworld would be like trying to arrest an elephant. Soon the newspapers began referring to Plant's hideout as the underworld, a word that later became synonymous with organized crime because its founder was, indeed, Chicago's first organized crime boss. Plant, a ruthless gangster, later retired on his illegal millions to become, as one historian stated, a patron of the turf who otherwise blossomed into a pattern of respectability. Like the word underworld, many of the words in this dictionary have a deep and significant history, and at one time or another, had many meanings. It should be noted that the first feature-length crime movie, Ben Heck's Underworld, 1927, dealt with organized crime in Chicago during the early 1920s and was inspired by Roger Plant's old underworld. Heck, who had been a Chicago newsman, was very much aware of Plant's history and that of the nethermost strata of his underground operations. The word sucker also has its roots in Chicago, where it was first recorded by the press as being used by gangsters referring to gullible victims of card cheats or anyone who believed anything they were told, particularly those bilked in rigged games like three-card Monte, pigeon drop, or faro. It was another Chicago crime boss, Big Mike McDonald, who ruled the city's underworld operations from the early 1870s to the turn of the century and used the word sucker in one of its most memorable applications. McDonald was first and foremost a gambler. He ran dozens of gambling dens in Chicago and would later be portrayed as the gambling czar in Edna Ferber's Showboat. McDonald's flagship operation, The Store, was an elegant four-story building at Monroe and Clark Streets. When this lavishly appointed gambling spa first opened, one of McDonald's lieutenants came to him and nervously pointed out the many faro and roulette tables they had installed. "We'll never get enough players to fill up the games," he told Big Mike. It was at that moment that McDonald, not showman P.T. Barnum as popularly believed, coined his shrewdest aphorism. "Don't worry about that," assured Big Mike. "There's a sucker born every minute." To be sure, New York often led the way in coining criminal terms. One of its most celebrated brothel saloon owners in the 1850s, John Allen, was credited with creating many terms still used today. It was Allen who casually informed reporters how visitors to his establishment and other notorious dives of the era were drugged by having knockout drops slipped into their drinks. Allen gave the name Mickey Finn to a drugged drink designed to render its victim powerless while being robbed or rolled. Chicago's Minna Everly and her sister Ada ran the nation's most elegant bordello during the late 1890s. Minna is also credited with coining roll and knockout drops. In one of her more famous speeches to her expensively attired girls, Minna intimated that the Everly Club entertained gentlemen exclusively and that the girls must maintain respectability at all times. She cautioned, "We know men better than you do. Don't rush them or roll them. We will permit no monkey shines, no knockout drops, no robberies, no crimes of any descriptions." Periodicals, too, began to detail the linguistics of the underworld and the police that combated crime. In New York City, outspoken and flamboyant crooks and killers such as Monk Eastman, Chick Tricker, Oney Madden, Big Jack Zelig, Jack Sirocco, and Paul Kelly openly gave interviews to reporters and magazine writers. At the turn of the century, Zelig was betrayed by fellow gangsters Sirocco and Tricker and sent to prison. When he was released, he hunted down Sirocco, finding him in a Bowery restaurant. In front of dozens of witnesses, including a writer for Century Magazine, Zelig boldly stuck a gun into Sirocco's stomach and shouted, "Within a week, you and Tricker will be cooked." The intent of his threat was obvious. Zelig was talking murder and introduced a new word to capture its meaning. Paul Kelly, leader of the Five Points Gang and New York's real crime boss during the first decade of the new century, fought many battles with his arch-rival Edward Monk Eastman. After Eastman was sent to Sing Sing to serve 10 years for a botched robbery in 1904, Kelly sat in his posh restaurant and gave an interview to several reporters, bemoaning the fate that had befallen his rival and sprinkling his monologue with underworld terms of that era. "Monk was a soft, easygoing fellow," Kelly said. "He had a gang of cowards behind him. Second story men, yeggs, flat robbers, and mowl buzzers. But he was a game fellow. I'd give $10,000 to see him out of prison." Oney Madden rose to the position of New York's crime czar, then retired and died comfortably in bed inside his Hot Springs, Arkansas mansion. During his reign, Madden led a gang of loft thieves. He also sold protection against himself to merchants and businessmen. Madden was so deadly with a knife or gun that he was known as the Killer, a moniker he relished. On the night of November 6, 1912, Madden entered the Arbor Dance Hall on 52nd Street and 7th Avenue, a den of thieves housing hundreds of Madden's fiercest adversaries. According to a newspaper report of the day, Oney the Killer strode boldly to the middle of the Arbor Dance Hall floor, and while the music faded and scores of hostile eyes glared at him, shouted to one and all, "Go on and have your fun. I won't bump anybody off here tonight." With that, Madden had rendered a new synonym for murder, one that would remain to the present time. He did not enjoy his bravado for long. Instead of leaving the enemy saloon, Madden took a seat in the balcony and smugly surveyed his opposition. Some hours later, when he was quite drunk, 11 gunmen pumped 6 bullets into him and left him for dead. Newspaper and periodical readers weaned on crime news began to turn to detective stories and crime novels by the early 1920s. Those written by Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and James M. Cain delved deeply into crime terminology. In Hammett's Maltese Falcon, private detective Sam Spade learns of the murder of his partner Miles Archer and states to police detectives, "Having Miles knocked off bothered me. and then you birds cracking foxy. In England, during this time, Edgar Wallace wrote hard-boiled detective fiction, which was liberally dosed with underworld terms. In When the Gangs Came to London, one of his characters talks about the machine gunning of a Chicago gangster, stating, "You remember Big Sam Polini? The choppers got him as he came out of mass one morning." Chicago writer W.R. Burnett spent years chronicling the life of Al Capone in his masterpiece of the underworld, Little Caesar, a crime novel studded with 1920s mob terms. His Capone-like character, Rico Bandello, blurts underworld argot with almost every breath. In preparing to rob a nightclub, Bandello instructs his henchmen, "Now, Otero, get this. I go first. You follow me with the big rod. I stick up the cashier. Tony swings the sax." Rico became the archetypal gangster in fiction and in movies, with Edward G. Robinson shooting to stardom in the title role of this 1931 classic. Rico's fierce street language is always pregnant with the threat of death. When taking over the gang, he barks at the cowering former leader, "Here's your split, Sam. I've been taking orders too long. We're done. If anybody gets yellow and squeals, my gun's gonna speak its peace." When Rico's world crashes, he flees to another city and is hunted by police and rival gangsters. He barely escapes assassination after being betrayed. Rico confronts his betrayers, snarling, "A guy tried to pop me over at Frank's. This bird has spilled something." A short time later, he is machine-gunned in an alley, abandoning argot for prayer with the classic line, "Mother of God, is this the end of Rico?" Even in the sophisticated work of the masterful detective writer Raymond Chandler, the dialogue of his memorable characters is replete with criminal jargon. In The Big Sleep, Chandler's indefatigable detective Philip Marlowe meets with low-life crook Harry Jones, who tersely describes the terrible killer Lash Canino. "He'd bump a guy off between drinks," Jones describes himself and his girlfriend thusly. "She's a grifter, Seamus. I'm a grifter. We're all grifters. So we sell each other out for a nickel." Marlowe, who was brilliantly portrayed by Humphrey Bogart in the movie version of The Big Sleep, later listens in hiding as he hears Canino tell Harry Jones that he is about to be killed, to be fitted for a Chicago overcoat. In Farewell, My Lovely, Marlowe takes on a bank robber client, a hulking brute who introduces himself with underworld argot. "They call me Moose Malloy on account of I'm large. The Grand Ben bank job, 40 grand, solo job. Ain't that something?" In the movie version of this hard-boiled detective novel, retitled Murder My Sweet, Dick Powell plays Marlowe, who is knocked out and drugged so his tormentors can learn the whereabouts of some missing jewelry. Marlowe awakens groggily in a locked room, talking to himself in the parlance of the underworld. "You're a tough guy. You can take it. You've been sapped down twice, had your throat choked, and been beaten half silly on the jaw with a gun barrel. You've been shot full of hop and kept under it until you're as crazy as two waltzing mice. Now let's see if you can do something really tough, like putting your pants on." In the murder novels of James M. Cain, the criminal street language infects the lethal characters portrayed, chiefly spouse killers. In Double Indemnity, insurance salesman Walter Neff and scheming client Phyllis Dietrichson, chillingly played on screen by Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck, plan to insure her husband, then kill him, making the murder appear to be an accident. Streetwise Neff quickly guesses the wife's intentions when she persists in getting an accidental insurance policy on her husband without his knowing it. "You want to knock him off, don't you, baby?" asks Neff. He joins her in planning her husband's death, describing his clever murder scheme as a way to clip the house with a shill to put down the bet. He warns Phyllis that Burton Keyes, the firm's wily investigator, craftily enacted by Edward G. Robinson, is a force to be overcome. "He'll never let go," says Neff. "He'll have you shadowed." Cora Smith and Frank Chambers are the scheming characters in Kane's The Postman Always Rings Twice. Both speak the argot of the criminal. They plan to kill Cora's elderly husband, Nick, and take over his roadside lunch counter. In the best film version of this thriller, John Garfield and Lana Turner play the cunning, lethal lovers. After arranging the death of Cora's husband, Frank is hoodwinked into signing a complaint against his co-conspirator. Then Cora appears to be compromised by her own attorney. The lovers next turn against each other. Frank moans, "We've been double-crossed, Cora. That lawyer Keats is nothing but a police stool pigeon." Cora spits back at Frank and her lawyer, "You two framed me." Newspapers and books introduced readers to the jargon of crime, but no other medium brought the language of the criminal to the public with as much impact as did motion pictures. As early as 1912, D.W. Griffith produced the first gangster film, The Musketeers of Pig Alley. In one of the first talking films, Lights of New York, a gang boss growled a chilling order to kill an opponent, "Take him for a ride." During the early 1930s, movie studios took their stories straight from the headlines that bannered the bloody careers of gangsters, bank robbers, kidnappers, and killers. One of the first of these was The Public Enemy, a starkly brutal portrait of Prohibition gangsters starring James Cagney in his first leading role. This gangster classic is studded with underworld terms. Cagney enacted the short and violent life of Tom Powers, a profile loosely based on Chicago gangster Charles Dion O'Banion. As an apprentice thief, Cagney is abandoned by his first mentor, one of whose cronies slams a door in his face when Cagney appears at the hideout for aid, telling him, "The heat's on." Cagney is then recruited as a bootlegger by Paddy Ryan, who tells him, "I got my own system, and being a fence isn't part of it." Leslie Fenton, playing the part of Nails Nathan, a character based on real-life Chicago mobster Samuel J. Nails Morton, takes Cagney under his wing, but warns, "If we're in the racket together, we got to keep the cheaters off." Fenton later complains to his enforcer Cagney that speakeasy owners are paying for their bootleg booze with phony checks, saying, "I'm getting fed up with these rubber checks bouncing. Bum paper." The language of the bootleg era is defined in The Public Enemy: Gat, Fagin, Pineapple, Gunsel. This was the case with other crime films of that era, including Little Caesar and Scarface, which starred Paul Muni as Tony Camonte, a murderous crime boss not unlike Al Capone. In Scarface, a submachine gun was a typewriter. A drug user was a hop. A policeman was a bull. To kill was to take. An arrest was a pinch. Young male criminals were hoodlums. To arrange for a murder was to arrange a setup. Muni would also star in another memorable crime drama, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. Imprisoned on a brutal chain gang, Muni escapes, or as it is termed in the film, he decides to hang it on the limb. Other prison films of the day, such as 20,000 Years in Sing Sing, The Big House, The Last Mile, and San Quentin, introduced a plethora of prison jargon to the public. In these big house epics, a man did not go to prison. He went to stir. He did not serve a term. He did a stretch. Inmates were cons. Prison guards were screws. And an escape was a break. Gangster films rolled throughout the 1930s with such movies as Angels with Dirty Faces and The Roaring Twenties, both starring James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. In both films, Cagney's good bad guy spews tough thug talk, but his heart leaks humanity. When facing a prison term in Angels, Cagney states, "It's my rap, and I'll take it." He bosses around a group of street kids. "Say your prayers, mugs." The well-armed Cagney is also so dangerous that a half-dozen rival gangsters fear to shoot it out with him. One of them says, "The guy is healed." In Roaring Twenties, Cagney and Bogart battled it out for control of a bootleg empire. Cagney, a one-time taxi driver, buys up taxis by the dozens, telling his lawyer, "If I want to buy 10,000 cabs, I'll buy them. Besides, they're a good front." When Bogart needlessly shoots a watchman, Cagney warns, "One of these days that heater of yours is going to blast you right into the hot seat." In the end, Cagney shoots Bogart and, in turn, is shot by Bogart. He staggers up the stairs of a church, then falls. His girlfriend, Gladys George, cradles the dead gangster as a cop rushes up to ask the identity of the dead man. In one of the most poignant film lines of the gangster era, George replies, "He used to be a big shot." More than a decade later, The Enforcer brought to the screen the savage story of Murder, Inc., with Humphrey Bogart as the district attorney probing into its sinister doings. He learns a strange new underworld language, wherein a gang of professional killers made up a troop. A murder assignment was a contract, and a murder was a hit. This story was expanded, and the language of this killer squad deepened into the more recent remake of Murder, Inc., starring Peter Falk. Films such as The Asphalt Jungle, starring Sterling Hayden, introduced a motley gang of jewel thieves out to make their big score, brazenly committing a heist against all odds. In Bonnie and Clyde, Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, playing the 1930s bank robber killers Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow, showed audiences exactly what it meant to make a getaway. In the television era, a spate of detective, police, and attorney shows introduced whole lexicons of criminal jargon. Viewers learned that wilding was a term coined by predatory sex criminals who hunted down lone female joggers to rape and murder in New York's Central Park. TV viewers were informed that a love weed meant marijuana, that ghetto meant heroin, and a junk dealer meant a drug pusher. The language of the criminal, the jargon of police, the argot of attorneys, all of this and more is to be found in the Dictionary of Crime, presenting a history of terms and phrases from ancient England to contemporary America. This dictionary provides solid definitions, each supplemented with the word's etymology and usage, as well as who used it and uses it. The criminals, police, detectives, attorneys, criminologists, forensic science practitioners, and prison and drug cultures. The Dictionary of Crime presents the whole broad spectrum of crime, a linguistic history echoing the whispers and calls of crooked paths and mean streets throughout the many lands of the English-speaking world.